everybody. I'm Karen Hart Glass. You are listening to It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me today. You know what I like to talk about. It's always about food. And since 2009, I've been doing just that. And checking the calendar, looks like it's time for a little quick celebration. Pop the champagne. It's been 15 years on the Progressive Radio Network, broadcasting It's All About Food. So thanks for joining my party today. Now, let's get on with the program. My guest today is Mel Weinstein, and we're going to talk about another favorite subject of mine that's somewhat related to food, and that is chemistry. Mel Weinstein is a retired chemist living in central Illinois. During the course of his professional career, he has taught chemistry at the community college level, spent 20 years as an analytical chemist in a research center for a multinational food ingredients manufacturer, studied food science, and pursued a lifelong interest in examining the ingredients in industrial foods and their impacts on human health. In 2016, he started a podcast called Food Labels Reveal to share knowledge of the processed food industry and to highlight the ever-growing trend of artificial foods appearing in the American food supply. And you can find out more at his website, Food Labels Revealed. Mel, nice to meet you today.
Oh, great to meet you, Karen. Been a fan of your podcast for many, many years, and have learned a lot, you know, from all the different guests you've had on just about every topic related to food.
That's right. So, every topic for 15 years.
What? Yeah. Yeah, that's a long time. I've been doing my podcast since 2016. So you definitely have eclipsed, you know, the number of years that I've been involved in.
Yeah, I took a course in podcasting a few years ago. Somebody gifted me this course. I didn't even know about it. It was in New York City. And I learned that 2009, the year I started this podcast, was kind of like when podcasts were just finding their way. 2009 was the year. Yeah. Were they going to make it or not?
Yeah. It was the very beginning. When I got into it in 2016, I thought that was early. Mm-hmm. And I struggled to figure out how to put a podcast together. So 15 years ago, you know, those were certainly pioneering days.
Yes. Well, lots of gratitude to Gary Null and the Progressive Radio Network for inviting me to join on this journey.
Yeah,
okay.
That's great.
So now let's talk about chemistry and chemicals. You know, one thing I like to say, and I've said it a few times in the recent past, there are good chemicals and there are bad chemicals. And a lot of times when people talk about chemicals, they think they are all bad. And my heart goes out to all those chemicals out there that are getting a bad rap.
Yeah. There's definitely prejudices.
Yeah, we have to understand human beings and all life on Earth is carbon-based. We are made of chemicals.
Right. Yeah, our human bodies are just extraordinary in terms of the chemistry that is occurring every moment of our existence. It's mind-boggling to think of the thousands, tens of thousands of chemical reactions that occur constantly to keep us functioning. Yeah, so
that's
to disk chemicals.
Body. Such a good point. The human body is this giant, sophisticated, I want to say 21st century, but it's so beyond what we're capable of.
Oh, yeah.
Laboratory. It is amazing. So high tech.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it all takes place really like we're not hardly aware of it most of the time, of what's happening inside our bodies.
Absolutely not. But then there are plenty of people out there on social media, bloggers and whatever, that will tell you they know what's going on.
You can know it if you study it, and that takes a lot of time and effort and money and conscientiousness. And so, you can learn a lot about how the human body operates, but most people don't care as long as it's operating the way it's supposed to. And but, you know, there are all kinds of impacts, as you know, on the functioning of the human body. And we're going to talk about some of that today. So you got your food, you got your environment, you've got chemicals that you use in your everyday life, cosmetics, pharmaceuticals. I mean, you name it. There is just all kinds of things in our lives that can impact the functioning of our bodies. And food is right up there, in my opinion.
Okay, my first question, when you were working with in the industrial food industry, were you making anything that wasn't good for us?
Well, I was an analytical chemist, so they didn't allow me to make any things, you know. So basically, I analyzed, tested different formulations that were being created by other chemists and food scientists in the company, you know. So they would be concocting something and they'd want to, you know, send samples down to the analytical laboratory. And I was one of, you know, maybe 20 chemists that would do a variety of tests on these products. And so in my area, they might want to know, well, you know, how much salt or how much sodium, for example, is in this product that I'm working on. So that's the kind of work I did. I wasn't one of the creators or originators, you know, of some new and strange, possibly food ingredient.
The term food ingredient has got to change, because I don't consider these thousands of food additives that are allowed in the food supply as food.
Yeah. Lately, I've been referring to them as non-foods. Or another phrase is food-like substances. Some of them behave like food, but, you know, they're completely made up.
Yeah. Man-made, synthetic-made.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we never really know what they're doing inside our bodies.
That's a big question. And
exactly.
it gets even worse than that, Karen. We tend to look at these chemicals, these food additives, as individuals, and never really ask the question, do they interact with each other? And I have yet, I mean, they may be out there, but I've yet to see any research studies looking at the possible interactions of chemicals that are in the foods. You know, do they act independently, or, you know, do the bad qualities of one additive affect the bad qualities of the other? Are they enhanced? And so that's a whole question mark out there. As far as I know, nobody's
that's
really
a giant subject. And if you know anything about chemistry, you know that there's a very, very high chance that all of them are having a big party and interacting as much as they can. And that's how they work.
Yeah. Well, just look at drugs. You know, can you name a drug where you didn't receive some sheet that came with it explaining all the interactions that that drug could have with other drugs or even with foods? And yeah, I mean, that's an obvious, but nobody is, like I said, as far as I know, nobody's really studying that.
Well, obviously one of the big problems is cost. And if you were in a chemistry class, in a science class in college back in the day, or even right now, and you're designing an experiment, you want to keep things as simple as possible, because the experiment can really get huge very quickly if you're evaluating too many things at the same time. And nobody wants to look at interactions. That's just too complicated. And then it makes the test expensive and hard to follow, and it could take too long, and you want to get some results. You want to get a grade.
Yeah.
And
it's complicated. Yeah. You know,
so
interpreting
people don't
the results.
Do it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they probably don't do it too, because they know that the results probably won't be good. And this way, if you don't do the work and you don't have the evidence, you don't look guilty.
Right. And we already have so many things to be concerned about. Boy, you know, just imagine, you know, adding that to the pile. We wouldn't be able to get a good night's sleep if all we thought about was what was happening, you know, with the chemicals we're consuming, not just consuming, but being exposed to. So you're right. It's not likely to happen. We got enough to worry about as it is.
Well, the problem is that when people get sick or they have some sort of autoimmune disease and they want to know the cause, it's really hard to find it. And right. One of the reasons is because of these additives. But then it's just a very interesting correlation that a lot of parents out there have discovered based on little nonprofits that have popped up or activists that have popped up saying that when they eliminate food additives from their children's diet, artificial colors and artificial ingredients, right, a lot of them see positive results.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of them see recovery and healing.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of signs out there if you want to look for them. And then the other interesting thing is sometimes other countries are banning the additives that we're using in the United States. And so you have to raise the question, what is it that they found was objectionable about these additives that our government is not concerned about? And as you just raised, you know, a lot of times it's coloring agents. And they sometimes these chemicals are actually banned. I'm particularly thinking in some European countries where they actually put it on the labels of their food packaging, that this can be harmful. So, okay, you know, got the differences.
Right. So one of the nice things that we have in this government is something called GRAS, generally recognized as safe. Yeah. And we've talked about that over the years. It's only been 15 years if it's all about food podcasting.
It's got to have come in somewhere. Yeah.
But can you just talk a little bit about it for some people who may not have heard of it?
Yeah. Cut me off if I get too deep into this, you know, because it is a pretty big subject. But I say GRAS, you say GRAS. It's an acronym. It stands for Generally Recognized as Safe.
That's a mouthful right there.
Yeah. Generally recognized as safe. Now, it came about as a result of the growing food science industry. Started probably even before World War II, but really took off after World War II, so late 40s, into the 50s. And there were people and organizations that began to question all these new food additives that were being added into the American food system. And they started asking questions. Are these chemicals really safe? Has there been experimental studies done to show that they are safe for humans to consume? Or if they're not safe, you know, maybe there should be some kind of designation as to, you know, the limit on how much of these additives can wind up in food before they become a problem. And so eventually the government listened, fortunately. And in the late 50s, they started passing some laws. And one of the laws had to do with the fact that we essentially need to come up with a list of approved additives. And once they got into it, they realized, and this was the FDA, was primarily responsible, Food and Drug Administration, for that, for fulfilling that law and coming up with the rules and regulations on determining what was GRAS and what was not. And they realized that this was a huge endeavor requiring a lot of people, a lot of time, a lot of money. And so a group of them decided, hey, you know, we don't have the ability to do this, at least in a quick fashion. And so They said, let's start here. You know, a lot of these chemicals have been around a long time. Some of them go back to the 19th century. We've been using them, you know, for all of these years. And can we make a determination? Hey, this has been in the food system for such a long time, and people aren't keeling over sick or dead from it. You know, so why don't we just call these particular chemicals safe? So that's where the GRAS, or generally recognized as safe chemical, list came from. Now, when they first started out, I may not have this number right, but it was somewhere between 500 and 800 substances wound up on the list. I mean, we're talking about stuff like, you know, baking soda, you know, baking powder, you know, things that have been used in the food industry for many, many years. So this list was created. Everybody was happy. But then the question arose, what are we going to do from this point forward? Okay, we've got this nice list of chemicals. A food manufacturer can refer to this list and say, hey, my food additive is on the list. I have nothing to worry about, which was true. You know, they had a pass. But new chemicals were a different story. And nowadays, it's hard to put our finger on it, but there's somewhere between 9 and 10,000 food additives allowed in the food supply. Okay, so take a look at that number, or that range I mentioned before, like 500 to 700, 800. Compare that to 9 to 10,000. I mean, that's a tenfold, more than a tenfold increase in the number of food substances entering our food supply from the late 1950s, we're talking like 1958, 1959, to the present time. And I didn't mention that a lot of the impetus for creating this GRAS list was cancer. Because also in the 1950s, there was a big drive to understand cancer, what caused cancer, how to come up with treatment for cancer and to cure it. And so there was a lots of people, lots of money went into this attempt to figure out cancer and to defeat it. So that was another part of this interest in understanding more about food additives, because people wanted to know, are these add can these additives cause cancer? Is this part of the problem? So we have all of these new chemicals entering the food system from the late 1950s on. And so then the FDA has to decide, well, what are we going to do with the new chemicals? Because, you know, these food manufacturers, they keep coming up with these new ingredients that have these different properties that are going to help them to sell foods in the commercial food industry. And they want them approved. You know, and they don't want to wait around 20 years for that. You know, they want a process that's going to approve them pretty quickly. So the FDA decides to expand the concept of GRAS. And don't ask me too many questions about this, because I don't quite understand it myself. But they gave food manufacturers basically two paths to follow. One, they could submit their new substances to the FDA to go through a full and comprehensive evaluation process to determine if that chemical was safe enough to be placed in foods. And that would take years to do, okay? Long could be a legal process, and manufacturers weren't real keen to accept path number one. Path number two said that, okay, you can submit a petition to have us look at your new food ingredient or new food additive, and we would look at the data and we would check it, you know, had a whole big long checklist. And some of these petitions are like hundreds of pages long, you know, they're complicated. But the and here's the key thing here, and this is this is something that probably 99% of the people don't know about. The onus for proving whether these additives were safe or not was on the manufacturers. Okay,
of course.
Not the government. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was no special agency in the government or special laboratory, you know, to examine these new substances. So it was left up to the manufacturers. The manufacturers, you know, they had a couple of choices. They could either do it in-house if they had the right research and analytical facilities for that, or they could hire a consulting company. And consulting company being the experts could go through the whole process and they could report back to the manufacturer, you know, everything's hunky-dory, go ahead and submit your petition, and we're pretty sure it's going to get approved. Well, the FDA basically had the same problem after the late 50s that they had in the late 50s. You know, they didn't have really the resources available to them to do a full and complete analysis of these additives. So they looked at the manufacturer's data and they made a determination based upon the data whether they thought this was safe enough to be in our food supply. And if it had some concerns about safety, then they would determine what the upper limit of the food additive amount that could be put into a food. And so that's what they did. And so most of these food additives got approved pretty rapidly. I'd say, you know, within a year or so. Sometimes there would be a few rejected, but it was a very small percentage of the total that got submitted. So every year, starting in the early 60s, literally hundreds of new additives came online.
Well, I can't even imagine how they determine limits and how they even do their tests. Are they testing them on people? Are they testing them on petri dishes? Are they testing them on animals?
In the early days, yeah, it was definitely animals. Yeah, mm-hmm. Laboratory mice or rats.
Eat this, try this. Okay, yeah, but unfortunately, yeah, the thing that we're discovering is that there is a tremendous cumulative effect of these ingredients. So, you know, a little taste here and there might not wreak havoc. But when you're consuming these things on a regular basis, it adds up.
Yes. Yeah, that's definitely what the more modern studies are showing. You know, that cumulative effect of consuming foods, industrialized foods with a lot of additives, particularly what are now called ultra processed foods, which we can talk about more later, that they do have an impact over time, and it's a serious impact.
Well, one of my favorites that was generally recognized as safe, however you say it, grass. Trans fats.
They oh, were boy.
Safe until they weren't safe, right?
Oh, yeah. That you and I are similar generation. And that's one of the things that kind of gets me upset. If you want to go into a little bit of history of trans fats, I don't want to get into too much chemistry here because we'll lose everybody except you and
no,
me.
Let's do it.
And
come on. Let's go for it.
Well, they trans fats go back to the early part of the 20th century, where, you know, butter was a really popular ingredient in foods, as everybody knows it still is. But there are chemists out there working in food industries that you know, told the executives of the company, you know, we can make something very similar to butter and a lot cheaper. We could make it taste like butter. We could make it look like butter. And it might be half the price. I don't remember exactly what mm-hmm. it was back in the 1920s.
And it'll last forever.
Oh, yeah. and this is what we know, you know, as margarine, right? But in order to make margarine, they had to come up with a special chemical process that would take a liquid fat, which we know as oil, and convert it to a solid fat. And so this process was called hydrogenation. Okay. And again, I gotta like stop myself. I don't want to get too chemistry here.
Yeah.
But hydrogenation essentially transformed liquid fat into more solid fat.
At room
okay
temperature.
Yeah, it would stay that way at room temperature. Yeah, at elevated temperatures, it would be
would melt.
Just like butter, it would melt. So there were degrees to this. Okay, so if you stop the process partway through, you got what were called trans fats, and they were still solid. And if you carried the process to completion, it's called, you know, total hydrogenation, you would get a very, very solid fat. Okay. Now, the problem with these fats is that they could go bad over time. I mean, you don't want that. As a commercial food producer, you want your products to sit on the shelf a long time, you know, without causing off tastes or off flavors. And so we know fats and oils can go rancid, and that's what makes them bad, you know, after a while. A little story behind that, I was at a family gathering, and there was a bunch of snacks being shared. And even though I've been doing this for a long time, you know, being involved in food chemistry and learning about food additives and doing the podcast and everything, nobody ever really asked me any questions about stuff like that. So they're eating these snacks at this family get together, and somebody opens up this bag of chips and they start eating the chips. And then they look around at the other people and they say, this stuff really smells bad. I mean, these are like one of the worst chips I've ever had. And people are, you know, beginning to pay attention. And so eventually I say, hey, hand the bag to me. And
rancid.
I take a sniff of it, just totally rancid, you know. So whatever oil was used to fry up these chips, you know, it was rancid. It was quite obvious. So that's what happens with oils over time. But when you make them into trans fats, they're more stable, okay, over time, both in terms of their staying abilities and their physical properties. And so this became, you know, very important to the food industry. And at that time, back in the 20s and 30s, they had to sell the American public on the concept of replacing butter, something people had been using, right, for hundreds of thousands of years, with this artificial stuff. And eventually they were able to do it. Actually, the butter manufacturing companies sued the margarine companies, but they prevailed. So this, okay, let's say 1920s. Now we're into 1960s, 70s, 80s. Margarine got on the grass list, right? I mean, it was not an ingredient, but as a product, it was considered safe and okay. And eventually, though, research revealed that there were components which generally got lumped under this category of trans fat, components in the margarine that affected the onset of heart disease. And it took, I don't know how many years, but for the government to review the data, you know, to pull something off of an approved use by the FDA. Takes a lot of work and effort and money. And so it took, I would say, I mean, do you know, it was like 5 years, 10 years or something?
Yeah, I don't know. It took a long time, but I still don't think we're entirely rid of them either.
Was supposed to be, but that's another story, which we can get to in a moment if you want. So eventually they got banned.
Yeah.
And they gave the food industry several years to transition whatever foods they had that were using trans fats to replace them with something that was safer. And so those of us of a certain age realize that, wait a second, Okay, if this stuff is was used since the 1920s, I was born in 1950. So by the time trans fats were banned, I had been consuming them for the majority of my life.
Sure. I
And
mean, as
a
a
lot of
vegan,
people.
we went to margarine to put in baked goods instead of butter.
Right, it was a replacement. But a lot of other people were using them too. So that was a shocker. And, who knows what the ultimate effects of that unintentional mistake was? Because, back in the 20s, they didn't have the ability to evaluate the potential causes of heart disease.
Yeah, so now take
So,
that and magnify it 1,000 times because you're talking about 9 to 10,000 food ingredients, and I'm sure not all of them are safe.
yeah, and this happens over time. If well, let me finish it out with trans fats. The reason we're not really fully done with them is the food industry got a, what would you call it? A pass. I'll just call it a pass from the FDA. And one of the rules the FDA passed was that if a food was analyzed and found to have less than 0.5 grams of trans fat, and trans fat's not a single molecule. I mean, it's a whole host of related chemicals. If it has less than a half a gram per serving, then it could be reported on the label as zero, zero, nilch, nothing. Okay, so let's say a sir,
And
let's say
some
a,
of these serving sizes are ridiculously low.
So if you have 50 servings in a container, I mean that's kind of, I'm kind of exaggerating there, but if each serving can have less than 0.5, let's just make it 0.5 to make it easy. That whole container can have 2.5 grams, right? Did they do the math right? It can have 2.5 grams of trans fat in it, and you would never know it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And there you go.
Now you mentioned other things that the FDA
Or is
eventually
it
banned.
25, 50 grams in the
I
whole
said that'd
bag?
be 50.
Then it's 25.
Well, it'd be half a, I'm taking half a percent.
Okay, not half a. All
Yeah,
right, whatever it
half a
is, it's
percent,
not good.
whatever it is, you're still getting a portion of trans fat in that food. So another, and the FDA doesn't ban a lot of additives that had gotten approved over the years. But it does happen every once in a while. If the data is there to prove that it's hazardous, they'll pull it, particularly if there's any connection with cancer. It gets pulled pretty quickly. Now there's one I'm going to mention here, is a food coloring, violet. I don't know if you heard of this situation, but back in the day, most people wouldn't know about this today because it hasn't been used for many years. But back in the day, the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, would stamp meat with their seal of approval. And they used a violet dye for that purpose. Do you remember that?
No.
Okay. You'd be in the grocery store, looking at the counter with all the meats, and you'd see this stamp, on a side of beef or something. And it was eventually connected with being carcinogenic, so they had to pull that.
The stamp.
Well, they pulled the dye that was
But
used for
right,
the
but the dye
stamp.
was in the stamp that was getting into the food.
Well, it was stamped directly on the meat.
Yeah, right. That's
Yeah.
good.
So,
Right.
we're not done. I'm sure in the rest of our lives we'll see other things like that
Well,
being
occasionally
removed.
we do hear something like there's the food babe, and she, what's her name, Bonnie Harry. She has highlighted a number of different strange ingredients that are in a lot of fast food items, and with her following, managed to get a company to take something out of their bread. I think it was Subway. There was a thing, and different groups can highlight a specific ingredient that a company is putting in their food, but we can't really depend on the government.
No, I mean, there's only one safe way to eat, in my opinion, which
Yes.
is the most difficult way to eat. But if you can avoid industrialized foods, then you avoid every problem, associated with food additives.
Yeah, and organic.
And again, oh yeah, I put together a rules list a few months ago, rules to eat by, and yeah, that's one of them, starting off with organic. Actually, number one rule was just eat whole foods from nature, period.
Right. We were talking about interactions before, and that's just what I started thinking of when we talk about glyphosate, this component in Roundup, and all the tests that have shown I'm air quoting safe. But there haven't been tests that have checked glyphosate with the other components found in Roundup Ready, and there is an understanding or a belief that the interactions, keyword interaction, makes it more powerful, makes it more dangerous, makes it more carcinogenic. And just magnify that by everything in the food system. We've got trouble.
Yeah, it's a difficult if you pay attention to all the details about what's in our food system, yeah, you'll go crazy,
Yeah. I have my own particular gripes. Maybe you could share some of yours, but a while ago I did a few posts on tortillas.
Okay.
Tortillas seem to be this such a simple food product, corn and water,
Sure.
right? Tortilla, you
Sure.
smash it into a pancake and it makes a
Yeah.
great wrap for people who
Right.
want to avoid gluten free. It's gluten
Yeah.
free. Okay, some people have corn allergies, but it's a pretty decent food.
Yeah,
You look,
masa.
right, you look at the back of a corn tortilla package. It's insane. It's got 50 ingredients, nothing you
Really?
want. Tortillas, it's got all kinds of
I
things.
just made enchiladas yesterday, and they were made from corn tortillas. I bought them in Kroger's. You may have heard of
Okay.
Kroger's, a big national chain. And I think there was only three or four ingredients on the
Okay, well, good
back.
for you, because most of them that are not in the cold case, that are just on a rack,
Right,
are filled with
right.
tons of ingredients. And so I always tend to, well, most of the time we make them ourselves at home. I buy organic
Yeah.
Masa Harina flour and we make them. But otherwise, it's going to a health food store and looking for the varieties that are just corn. Some of them have salt.
Right.
And that's it. But the problem is those have to be refrigerated. They can't put those organic
On the
varieties on the
shelf.
shelf because they're going to
Yeah.
mold like instantly.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Yeah.
that's my little beef
It's the
with tortillas.
price you pay for convenience, which is a whole nother issue in our society, to be able to have the foods when we want them, put them where we want them, make them last a long time, and not have to worry about it, supposedly.
So you put together this book, Food Labels Revealed, and you have all these different foods that you've studied and talked about the ingredients that are in them. All of them are fast food, highly processed things that I would like to hope that most of my listeners don't eat, but I haven't done a survey.
Well, you might be surprised. Yeah,
Exactly. Surprise me.
the book is called Fast Food Ingredients Revealed.
Ah.
What are you eating? And yeah, I have to admit, I will still occasionally eat in a fast food restaurant. It's low on my list of, what I'd like to do, but you find yourself in a pinch somewhere, you're starving, and there aren't a lot of choices. Particularly as far as plant-based options are concerned. And I also have to admit that occasionally there's something from my childhood or from my young adulthood that I really like to eat, and I will indulge every once in a while. You know, like in Taco Bell, I'd say I maybe once or twice a year I will get bean burritos, you know, because I always like those. So you know, you take your chances a little bit here and there, but in general, you know, I eat a pretty solid, fairly clean diet. I try to make as much food from scratch as I can. I pay attention to ingredients on labels, as you might expect. And I would think most Americans are probably like that, that they, even if they have this idea that eating in fast food restaurants is not healthy, they probably will break that rule periodically, particularly in social situations too, that you find yourself in. But anyway, the book is based upon this podcast called Food Labels Revealed that I've been doing since 2016. Basically, after I retired, I thought, okay, I've got time on my hands. I can take up new hobbies, do different things. But then I thought, you know, I've accumulated a lot of information and knowledge based upon my years as a teacher, chemistry teacher, and as an industrial analytical chemist working in a food ingredient industry. That, you know, why don't I take this information and make it available to people? You know, because I kind of looked around, probably like you did when you started your podcast. There was no other podcast on that subject, you know, talking about ingredients and foods and nutrition and relationship of health to it. So actually, probably was more like 2014. I had the idea and I started working on it and I just ran into a dead end. I gave up, you know, walked away from it for 2 years. I think I made one or two episodes, never put them out there. So I came back 2 years later with more conscientiousness and grit, I guess, and decided I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it for a while to see if it works. And so then I started, you know, putting out a podcast every month, picking generally some kind of industrial food. I started with cereals. That was like the obvious place to start. And just started evaluating these different foods, comparing them one against the other. You know, I try to find a bad example versus a good example, you know, to give people an idea what the differences were. And so this went on for a number of years, maybe 4 or 5 years. And then it dawned on me. I said, now, wait a second. I'm not looking at this huge area of the food industry, fast foods. I'm just looking at stuff you buy in the grocery stores, you know, products that have food labels, that have, you know, nutrition facts labels on them, ingredient lists. What about these foods that are sold in places like McDonald's and Taco Bell and Pizza Hut and other ones? So I started out with this question. Are the ingredients that are used in fast food products, are they any different than the ones that we find in grocery stores? So I started looking around for fast food restaurants that would actually tell me what ingredients were in their products, you know, because they don't have to put any labels on their stuff, right? So I couldn't walk into a McDonald's and say, okay, what's in your Big Mac or what's your French fries? You know, I'd get, you know, probably a crazy look from the person behind the counter. What are you talking about? So I started going online and starting looked up different fast food restaurants to see were there any out there that actually provided that information to the general public at their websites. And lo and behold, I found maybe a dozen or so that actually listed the ingredients, if not for all of their menu items, for a large number of them. And I said, aha, great. Here's the data. All I've got to do is take the data, you know, organize it, crunch it, blah, blah, and I'll have the answer to that question. Now you might say, okay, I found 12 or so restaurants online. What about the rest of them? There are hundreds, as you know, fast food restaurants in this country. So the vast majority of them did not provide that information. So I looked at, I thought I'd look at three restaurants, and those are the ones I just mentioned, McDonald's, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell, for a couple of reasons. And, they're some of the biggest restaurants in the country, if not the world. Very, very popular. They had a very proven system for selling fast food. They're very good at what they did. And they kind of represented Americana. I mean, you've got hamburgers, French fries, pizza, and Mexican food. I mean, that covers a lot of ground. So basically, what I found out was that the vast majority of the ingredients used by fast food restaurants were the same.
Nope.
Okay. Every once in a while, there'd be some differences, but they were generally the same as what you'd find in any of the products in the grocery store. Stepping back a little bit, I want to mention if this question is coming up in people's mind, why don't restaurants have to reveal what's in their food? Okay. Now, when I say reveal, I'm talking about the actual ingredients. Now, we have the food item, okay? Let's say you're in McDonald's, you have the Big Mac. Okay, that's the food item. Then you have the components that are in the Big Mac, right? You got the bun, you got the patty, you got the lettuce, the special sauce,
And each one of
whatever
those
it
has
is.
ingredients.
Yeah, and then you break down the component. That's where you get the ingredients, okay? So that's what I did for every menu item in each of those three restaurants. It turned out to be over 300. Broke them down that way until I got to the ingredient list. Okay, so I didn't answer the question, why don't they have to reveal the ingredients? Well, legally they don't. There's no law requiring that. Anyway, so I broke down all of these menu items into the individual ingredients. And then I was also then interested in which of these ingredients, well, let me say how industrialized are. Now, a lot of people would use the word processed. How processed are these menu items, and how industrialized are the ingredients that are in them? So I basically decided I was going to create my own rating system. There's no handbook you can go to, no guide, and open it up to just picking an additive off the top of my head. Let's say lecithin. Okay, you can't go to any resource and look up lecithin and see how industrialized is it. Is this a natural product? Has it been processed in some way to make it less and less natural? So I decided I would just create my own system based upon my experience and knowledge with the ingredient or my researching of that ingredient. So I essentially assigned every single ingredient that I encountered as either being unprocessed. There are like five categories: unprocessed, slightly processed, moderately processed, highly, and then finally extremely processed. Okay, now to make the extremely processed category, that was something that was totally synthetic, made from scratch in a factory, didn't exist out in the natural world. There's a few exceptions there, because there are additives that are made in the laboratory and made in a factory that do exist in nature. Okay, so it depends upon the usage of it. Are you getting it from nature, extracting it out and purifying it, or are you making it in the laboratory? Well, unfortunately, most of the time it is more convenient and less expensive to make it in the laboratory than it is to get it from nature. So
And from a
most food
vegan point of
companies
view,
do.
there are some ingredients that we don't want to obtain from nature because they only can be obtained from an animal. And so they can make it in a laboratory and it's
True.
considered vegan. May not be healthy,
Right.
but a lot of
No,
vitamins, a
I
lot of
mean, I,
supplements are like that.
in the last year, one of the things I still like to eat and I don't make from scratch is cream cheese. And you probably have heard that there are companies now making cream cheese from artificial whey.
Yes. Oh,
Okay, so
good. Yeah.
doesn't come from the animal.
Right.
It's a kind of
That's
a
a whole nother
bioengineered.
podcast. And I
Yes,
think
it
everybody
is.
knows that Karen
I
does not like synthetic
know.
ingredients to mimic animal ingredients that we know are not good for us.
Yeah.
And
So anyway,
yeah.
I don't know
So
how
we
we
just
got
have a
on that
couple of minutes
subject.
left, Mel.
Wow. What do you want to talk about?
Yeah, so was there a surprising ingredient or something you were going to tell me about?
There's a handful of them. I don't know which ones you want to talk about.
2 minutes.
The 2 minutes. Wow. Okay. I'll pick one that I
Okay.
let me pick one that covers two categories or
Cool.
two subjects. People may have seen this word on ingredient lists. It's a DATEM. D as in dog, ATEM. Okay, now when people see that on a label, they probably pronounce that as datum, the ingredient datum. Well, datum is an acronym. And so there is no such thing as datum. It's just simply the letters of the name of the chemical. And most oftentimes these are mixtures of chemicals, not just one chemical. But here's what it is. It stands for diacetyl tartaric acid esters of mono and diglycerides. Now, as a chemist, I love to say that. I mean, it just falls off my tongue, right? So this particular ingredient is found in the McDonald's hamburger bun. Its properties are that it's used as an emulsifier and a dough conditioner. Some companies don't sell products that have it in them. For example, Whole Foods will not sell any bread products that have datum in them. And it's an example then of another wave that the FDA provides food manufacturers is that they don't have to actually write out the name of the ingredient on the food label. They throw out this acronym, and who the heck, unless you're a chemist, or a chemist or somebody working in the food industry, you're not going to know what that is. And if you want to know what it is, you're going to have to take the time to look it up. So that's an example of a very chemically produced synthetic food additive.
Right. Now we see mono and diglycerides on ingredient lists all the time, but not
Right.
datum.
Yeah, they could be used separately. They have their own function, or they get combined with other things. Yeah.
Wow.
You want any
So,
more? We out of time, or you?
yeah. So, what's the moral of this story, Mel? I think it's back to the list of foods you were talking about that are okay to eat.
Yeah, it basically comes down to we're responsible for our own health. And for that responsibility, we need to make the best choices that we can. In the latter part of my book, there was a chapter on latest research studies on the effects of highly industrialized foods or ultra-processed foods on human health. And surprisingly, when I didn't realize it until I got into looking up these articles, that a lot of research has taken place in the last 10 years. And it's pretty demonstrative, in my opinion, that there's a strong connection between the development of lifestyle diseases heart disease, diabetes, obesity, and so on and so on. With the overconsumption of ultra-processed foods, every single study, one after another, showing these connections. And they usually report it as, they take kind of an average, and then over a large group of people. And then if you're eating two times as much of the ultra processed foods than the average person, then your risk of getting one of these diseases increases by 10%. That's usually how they report it, you know. So if you're eating three times as much, then it's like, 20%, 30% higher. So the evidence is mounting, and so that's something else to pay attention to, you know. Now the unfortunate thing about a diet that's rich in ultra processed foods that you're eating, you're not going to know about it, particularly if you're young. You know, you're in your teens and your 20s, you ain't going to notice probably a thing unless you got some kind of allergy or some kind of special health
Yeah.
problem.
Mel, thank
Yeah.
you. So much
Okay.
information. All those ingredients out there that we don't know about, but we should be paying attention to. Thank you for joining me on It's All About the
Yeah,
Food,
you're
and thank you
welcome.
for all your work. I'll link your website in this podcast post. I hope people take a visit and pay attention. That's the message.
Right.
Pay
Right.
attention to what you're eating.
Okay, thank you, Karen.
All right. Take care, Mel. Take care, everybody. Have a delicious week. Bye-bye.